Welcome to another episode of Differences Not Deficits, where we discuss what we are learning and changing in our therapy so we can support and empower neurodivergent individuals with compassion and respect. Thank you for listening so we can all learn together.
The primary purpose of Differences Not Deficits is to educate and inform. The views expressed during this podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not constitute educational or medical advice. Listeners should consult with their professionals familiar with each individual or family for specific guidance.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Differences Not Deficits podcast. Today, we are excited to share an interview we had with Matt Lowry. This will be part one of two episodes with Matt. Matt is an autistic licensed psychological practitioner in Louisville, Kentucky. He provides evaluations and therapy for children, teens, and adults, using a strengths-based approach to help autistic people in ways best suited for their individual needs. He also provides educational trainings and co-hosts the Autistic Culture podcast, where they discuss autistic contributions to society and culture. He has a passion to make the world a better place for autistic people. So let's get started. Matt, we are so excited to have you here.
Good to meet you all.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your story, your journey as an autistic person?
Oh, man. My story is long and convoluted. Looking back, clearly autistic kid. I loved organizing my toys, lining up my toys. I ate Campbell's vegetable beef soup every day for lunch for 12 years. Well, that and saltine crackers, because that is the only acceptable lunch. They wanted to do a test when I was in first grade, but by all accounts, I don't personally remember this, but I panicked and ran out of the room because it was taking place after school, and I was terrified that the school would lock the doors and I would be trapped overnight forever. So I did not finish the testing. And then I had my same teacher for third grade, and she said, "Hey, perhaps we should try that testing again in the middle of the day so he won't be freaked out and try to run away." So they did the testing. And then immediately after that, I was placed in gifted classes, and a psychologist started following me around and asking me to do tests. And I would watch like 3-2-1 Contact while having a conversation about Planet of the Apes, while building Legos and that kind of stuff. And I never knew why, but I was like, oh, yeah, I got money and I can buy Ghostbusters toys. This rocks. So I did that for many, many years, and I was in the gifted program. And eventually, I was in a program in high school where I got to work in a lab at UK. And I started UK when I was 14, working in the physiology lab. And we were studying desynchronization of gonadotropins and how they affect the estrous cycle, as one does. And one of the grad students from the autism lab came in and was like, "Did you know you have Asperger's?" And I was like, "No, what's that?" And so long story short, I eventually started working in the autism lab. And the guy who was the head of the autism lab was the guy who was following me around and making me do all these tests. It turns out I was part of his study about twice exceptional kids. And turns out that he knew way before I did. So after that, I started studying the autism and working with autistic people. And I spent many years being very vocal about being pro-autistic, but then I worked in community mental health for a while, and that was very discouraging. So I went right back into the neuro closet until my son was born. And as soon as he started fixating on the ceiling fans and watching things spin, and those were the only things that he liked to do, and watching the same thing over and over and over again, because I thought it was totally cool, because I was like, oh, yeah, the little guys like me. And my ex was, no, everything about this is very, 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 very wrong. Aww. And I was like, really? So so I became a very vocal activist, because I want to make the world a better place for kids like my son, and indirectly myself, because I think that the world needs to learn that we are in fact human beings and not weird stereotypes. There's a lot of people that believe that we don't have empathy. There's a lot of people that believe we don't have feelings. There's a lot of people I didn't know this, that believe that we can't reproduce. That was a new one to me. I encounter a lot of very, very, very weird biases. Earlier this week, I was explaining stuff to a neurotypical family, and one of them said, "Well, that doesn't count coming from you because you don't have empathy." And I was like, "Okay, homework is researching the Milton double empathy problem. Please do that."
I mean, we're not talking about a different species here. We're talking about humans.
We are somehow alien. And it's getting the word out that we are in fact human beings with human feelings. We just like our data, and we like collecting things, and we like talking about things we like to talk about. And we find the phrase, how are you? I am fine, to be baffling. But yeah. So here we are. That brings us roughly to now.
Unbelievable.
I mean, I'm kind of speechless for a second. I'm like, you're right. There are so many people who think that, an autistic person is so different, but we all have the same human functions. We all do. I mean, even if the brain is just different, and that's kind of why we called our podcast Differences, Not Deficits, because it's just a difference. It's not because it's wrong or it's just another that you just don't
Exactly.
understand, and you have to take the time to learn it. Otherwise, you're not going to get it. And so,
It's do your research, right?
Exactly. Oh, well, that's the thing. That's the thing. We love research. We love data. We love learning. We love understanding, because so this is a big thing that a lot of people don't get about the brain, is that because of our immunity to the mTOR protein, we don't do the synaptic pruning like most people do. And because of that, our brains become hyper dense and hyper connected. And therefore, we have a really, really big data hunger, because we're constantly churning through data, and we want to understand the world on a minutia level. And we love understanding, we love getting as much data as possible, because we do what we call bottom up processing. And we do data, 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 and then we have a whole picture. But most of the world, because of the synaptic pruning, sees the world from a top-down processing, where they have an idea of something and they feel that it's right, and they have a gut feeling that this is the right way to do things. And you say, "Well, data doesn't indicate that," and they say, "Well, that doesn't matter, because I believe it anyway, because my beliefs are very important." And again, that's where, educating people about autism comes in, because again, even talking to professionals of, "Yes, my son is biologically produced by me. I was there. I didn't take pictures, because that would be awkward. But I guarantee you that he is biologically related to me." And they say, "Are you sure about that? Because I heard that autistic people can't have intercourse." And like, "No, why would you believe that?" "Well, I just heard it, and I'm going to continue believing
I don't even know how to process that information.
it."
I mean, I guess I am more of the, data, 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 and then it makes sense to me. But at the same time, it's like how it doesn't compute in my brain.
When I talked to you last time,
Well,
I was so taken aback by someone saying that to you. I just it just doesn't make sense.
well, that's the thing. I don't know how to respond to that, because, are you denied basic biological functioning? And like,
Like we all
no,
had the talk,
no.
and we all had
Why
the
do you
same
believe
talk.
that? It's fascinating, because again, the weird belief that we are somehow subhuman, it's fascinating to me. It's and also horrifying. But yeah, it is just and that's the thing that I think that persists as far as discrimination goes, because it's a lot easier to discriminate against somebody if they are not equal, if they are somehow deficient. And again, differences, not deficits, because it's everybody functions in a different way. For okay, so one of the greatest examples that I love of integrated neurotypes is Ghostbusters, because Ghostbusters, very, very much an autistic centered story, written by an autistic man, Dan Aykroyd. Dan Aykroyd is openly autistic. He and Harold Ramis, when he wrote the story himself, and then Ivan Reitman said, "Well, this script would cost around $180 billion to produce. I'm going to pair you with my friend Harold Ramis, and you guys kind of work something out to where it's filmable." Because again, they were going to go through
Right.
dimensions and fight Stay Puft level baddies like every 10 minutes. And so anyway, Harold Ramis brought a little grounded, and again, he may be one of us, he may have been one of us himself, but in writing the script, Harold Ramis decided to create the character of Egon to be another autistic voice. So it was a very conscious decision to make both Ray and Egon autistic. But Peter's clearly neurodivergent in some way, but Winston is the neurotypical of the group. Janine is the neurotypical of the group. And in those ways, especially in like Ghostbusters Afterlife, the most recent, there's a new movie coming out next month. I very much can't wait to see it. But in Ghostbusters Afterlife, there's a big explanation about how both Ray and Egon are very, very involved in the minutiae of creation of equipment, studying the paranormal,
Right.
studying ghosts. But they're very, very bad with day-to-day finances. Ray is constantly on the brink of bankruptcy. Egon couldn't maintain, his farm because he was so busy saving the world from ghosts. So Janine, essentially, took care of the day-to-day stuff for him because that's her strength. And Winston took care of, Ray's bookshop because Ray brought him into the world of Ghostbusters, taught him about the intensity, taught him about all this stuff. So Winston returned the favor. And it's this excellent reciprocal relationship where each plays upon their strengths because, Winston is great with the day-to-day stuff. He's great with finances. He's now extremely wealthy, whereas Ray continues the research and continues the understanding, and Winston loves it. So there, it's a very, very great symbiotic relationship amongst neurotypes. And that's why the team works as well as it does. And again, Peter's neurodivergent in some way. There's a lot of Bill Murray going on in there, whatever Bill Murray actually is, because it's actually him. But that's the thing. It's an amazing family with all these different backgrounds making it all work together.
And wouldn't that be lovely if, yeah, we could just build on our strengths? We each have our own strengths. So it's not that we're any one of us is wrong or not worthy. You
Yeah,
know, it's just, yeah. So very good.
exactly.
Yeah, that's a very Sorry, my cat is just has a mind of her own right now.
I
Very
have a
interesting.
way of my
Bringing
voice
the cat.
attracts cats,
I
so
mean, it's working. She is just trying so hard to get in this space.
Love
Yeah,
them.
no, but that's fascinating about, the Ghostbuster movie, because you're right. If you actually really look at all the individual people, you can kind of pick up that, I don't want to say autistic language, but it's there. And
Well, I
it's
love you
that. It
bringing it
is.
to light because I never really thought of it that way, honestly, but that's, I love it. It's awesome.
And when you look at it, Ghostbusters 2 is all about alexithymia
Ooh.
because it's all about this undercurrent of emotion that affects everyone and causes these very, very intense bouts of emotion, which Dan Aykroyd has talked about his own experience with, which is what led to his
Wow.
diagnosis. And Egon in the movie is studying emotion and how environmental factors affect emotion. And that is the autistic condition in a nutshell, because there's all these numerous factors around us that impact us in ways that we don't necessarily understand. But how do we solve that? By study and by research and by learning and by data gathering. Because this is the way. We are the researchers and the archivists and the museum curators of the world, and this is how our society
Yeah.
rolls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
Wow. We would love to ask you about so in our practice we focus greatly on interoception, exteroception, body awareness. That's one of the main things we
Oh, yes.
focus on because it's really not out here. You don't hear about it. I first discovered it through Kelly Mahler,
Oh, yeah.
and would just love to get your insights on that and how important that is for, individuals.
Incredibly. I once gave a so when I do autism evaluations, I try to be as thorough in autism stuff as possible and record stuff like proprioception, exteroception, interoception, all this stuff that makes us actually autistic. And I gave this report to a woman. It was 15 pages long. She gave it to her therapist, and her therapist says, "I don't know, this looks kind of sketchy. I've never heard of interoception before." And
Oh
it's
my.
like, there's Google, my friend.
That's what I was just going to say. Why would you not look it up?
Because again, top-down thinking, I know everything. I don't need to learn things. What is this strange word? He must be making it up. And yeah, but that's the thing. Interoception is this internal awareness, this awareness of these internal senses. And oftentimes, the we ignore these senses, like hunger, thirst, feeling full, needing to go to the bathroom, feeling tired. We push past our limits because we're not paying attention to our meat bodies. Or it's like driving a car with the check engine light on, and we don't know exactly why the check engine light is on. So we say, "Well, maybe I haven't eaten today." So you eat. Maybe I haven't drank today. Well, maybe it's that I got 2 hours of sleep last night. And we have to go through a checklist to try to figure out why our meat body is rebelling against us. And it's much more difficult because of what we call alexithymia, because if we don't have a good awareness of what these signals are, how to identify them, and it's even with emotions, because we tend to cognitively process emotions rather than physically feel them. And that's an interesting thing about this, because I had no idea that the phrase "to get cold feet" literally means that many people, when they feel anxious, their feet feel physically cold. I was not aware of that, because
I don't think I was aware of that. I mean, I know that you're like scared and you don't want to do it and you're having second
I'm
thoughts,
not
but
aware of
like,
that.
do people actually get cold feet?
I learned this from a neurotypical person, because, like, well, of course it makes sense, because when you're afraid, you feel cold in your feet. And I'm like, I don't. I
I
just
don't.
feel shaky and sweaty, and and that's
Is that true? I don't. That's new to me too. Like, I don't feel my feet cold. That is interesting. I mean, I knew the phrase and what it meant because, you know, we all learn our
Interesting.
idioms and we learn our whatever. And
It's
yeah,
fascinating.
I only knew it as an idiom. Yeah, that's very strange. I'd have to wonder about the neurotypical person that you talk to, honestly.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing. I did research on it, and this lines up with so when neurotypical people feel afraid, they feel cold in their extremities. That they feel cold in their body. When they feel sad, they feel cold. When they feel happy, they feel warm. When but that's the thing. We tend to get headaches, chest pains, stomach aches, sweaty. We cognitively process and say, based on the available data, which is this and this and this and this, I'm feeling stressed out because my car is not working today. And instead of physically feeling these emotions, and that's the reason when people go to therapy, a lot of therapy doesn't work, because they say, "Where are you feeling that?" And we're like, "In my brain, where my feelings live." And And it's fascinating that there is a complete different operating system at work there, and that a lot of language that is developed for a big section of the population does not work for another section. And that is
It's
fascinating.
been fascinating for us to see the discoveries as we kind of introduce the interception and bring that body awareness. Big discovery.
The body awareness, it's essential, because again, you're going to be living in your meat body for the rest of your life, so you need to get accustomed to it. You need to read the
Yeah,
manual.
absolutely.
No, absolutely. And I think a lot of our parents that we work with, and we're discovering that, you know, as we're working with, you know, young adults and teens, it's tapping into how they feel and process that emotion. But so much is to do with the parent because there's no co-regulation part that goes with that. There's no, you know, understanding of, well, I don't feel this. How can you feel it? You're wrong. And so like, oh, I get warm really quick and it might be raining outside and whatever, but it's because of the pressure and the atmospheric drop and all these things. I can explain why I am sweaty and feel, yuck, but to a person, it's like, well, it's cold. What's wrong with you? Turn on the heat. I'm like, well,
Right. But there's so many other factors. There's so much other data that your body is
yes.
processing.
Yeah, absolutely.
absolutely.
No, so we are one of the believers too that, interception is kind of, if you, that's the foundation. If you don't even know how you think and feel, how can you access any therapy or anything in your life? Because how do you actually balance yourself and not have that traumatic attachment to it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on that note, since Yolandi brought in the trauma piece, that is something we would love for you to speak about because
Oh, man.
we actually started our podcast with a discussion about my own trauma, like just growing up, my own experience. And I felt for a long time that it must be traumatic for an autistic person to just be born into this world, this chaos of a world. So
Yes.
I would love for you to speak to that and the different types of trauma that can occur for an autistic person.
So when people think of trauma, they usually think of the big trauma,
Right.
like a life-altering event. Studies have shown that 94%, I believe 92, 90, 9 out of 10 autistic women or assigned female at birth people are sexually assaulted before the age of 18.
Yeah.
So that is a big trauma. There are, I could not find statistics on males or trans people because again, there's biases in such research. But again, part of that is due to us believing that we tend to be very upfront, we tend to be very blunt, we tend to be very honest, and a lot of people take advantage of that. There's a lot of people who smell blood in the water and say, there is a person that I can victimize and they'll never tell anyone because I can make them feel ashamed of it and make it their fault. And that happens a lot to us.
Yes.
And on the flip side of that, there is what we call complex PTSD. And the complex trauma is so common among autistic people that a lot of neurotypical evaluators have a very difficult time identifying what's CPTSD and what's autism. Because, again, the only way that they can identify autistic people is by autistic distress. Meltdown, shutdown, situational mutism, all that kind of stuff, because they don't come across healthy autistic people who have not been traumatized because we're fairly rare. If you're going in for an evaluation, very few people say, "Yeah, I just want to know about myself. I think I might have the tisms. Let me tell me all about it." It's I'm having difficulty. I've had meltdowns. I've been in burnout. I need help, and that's when people are discovered. And so complex trauma can involve like a lifetime of social rejection where, kids at school say, "Ah, that's it's weird that you talk about birds all the time. Why do you only want to talk about birds?" Or, "Man, none of your clothes match. Why don't your clothes match? Your clothes should match more." Or, "Boy, you talk weird. Why do you talk so weird? You're using words that nobody else uses." And that constant feeling of rejection is just crushing, especially if it happens over and over and over again. Because if you don't know your people, if you don't know that this is normal for us, I'm dating myself because I go back to the Blind Melon No Rain video with the bumblebee girl. And if you're too young before, if you only know MTV as showing reality shows and not music videos, please YouTube it because it's all about this girl dressed in a bumblebee suit who is dancing on stage and people are laughing at her. And she goes in search of her people and she finds the land of the bumblebee people. And I really, really think that, oh man, who is the lead singer of Blind Melon? I can't remember his name. I'm blanking.
No.
I'll blurt it out randomly in about 20 minutes. The listeners are yelling it already, but here we
Sure.
are. But I really think that he was probably one of us as well. Shannon Hoon. Sh Hoon, yes. But I heard you, listeners. Well done. Yeah, but that's a big thing about us because we need to find our people and know that we are who we are and that we're not broken. We're just wired differently.
Absolutely.
It again, not a deficit. It is just it's a feature, not a bug.
Absolutely. I think a huge thing you kind of pointed out too is that autistic burnout that does happen. You
Yes.
have so much rejection and you have so many things. I mean, you're trying to learn a language that it seems like you're never going to be able to learn because number one, people won't let you.
Yeah.
So it's hard to kind of get there, but that autistic burnout is real and it could be weeks, it could be years, it could be months. So to you, what would an autistic kind of burnout look like?
Oh man, I have been there several times in my life, and that's the thing about being autistic. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Because we live in a world that overtaxes us, with exteroception. We're constantly bombarded by sensory data, lights, sounds, even chemicals, because our meat bodies are incredibly sensitive to the world around us. We don't pay attention to our internal signals. We push ourselves past our limits. We go without eating healthy foods. We go without healthy sleep. We often have sleep apnea because we forget to breathe at night. We forget to breathe while we're talking, hence the autistic accent. But because of all of this, because we live in a world that expects us to work in a cubicle with, lighting that's terrible, and to constantly socialize and say, "Hi, how are you? I am fine. How are you? I am also fine." And we have to take breaks and shift in and out of our autistic monotropism. And we have to constantly overextend ourselves and constantly mask in order to just survive. We will hit burnout, and you have to protect yourselves. It's honestly, I really think that there deserves to be a better term than just burnout, because anybody can hit burnout, but autistic burnout is an exhaustion of the soul. It is something so more intense to where you lose basic functionality, and you just it's incredibly difficult to even get out of bed. It's difficult to feed yourself, to clothe yourself, to bathe. Literally anything is too taxing because your brain is already processing so much data, you just can't do any more. You are taxed to your absolute limit, and your body is like an iPhone that has not been charged, and you have to wait for it to get rid of that blinking battery before you can even turn it on. And it's a thing that can kill us. We have an average life expectancy of 36.
That's awful.
It is. Part of it is due to extreme burnout. Part of it is due to a lot of health issues associated with being autistic, like EDS, POTS, mast cell. And a lot of it is hitting a burnout point, thinking that you will never get out of it, and then making a decision to leave the planet. And that is incredibly heartbreaking, because rather than have a world that is more accepting of differences and more accommodating of differences, a lot of people say, "Ah, this is clearly a personal failing on your part. I can get up every day and do these things. Why can't you? You're clearly defective."
Even to the extreme of like, oh, you're having a bad day and doing all this, but there are so much more that actually comes with that feeling, and it's that inability to do anything, even the mundane things like brush your teeth and
Exactly.
remember to drink water before so you don't get so dehydrated.
Yeah.
No, so I appreciate your thoughts on that because we see that even so many in our young adults that they're just in this. They're trying to figure out the world. They're trying to figure out where I need to go to school. And some of them are so highly intelligent that the expectation is you will be going to college. You will be pushed higher to do these things and you will, have this life. But if you're in that burnout state, how can you even process what you want to eat in the morning? Like, so we see that so often. And what are some of your recommendations to kind of help people break out of that burnout? I think that's kind of what the obstacle is that we're coming across.
Intense self-care, intense support, because we no person is an island. Everyone needs support. Everyone needs community. And if you need assistance with things, please don't be ashamed to ask for assistance. You need to feed your meat body. You need to treat it like a Tamagotchi. You need to put it to bed at a certain time. You need to feed it good food. You need to make sure that you're breathing. You need to get rid of as much stress and put off as much as you possibly can in order to recover, and ask for help when you need, because if somebody can take over part of the load, then by all means, for the love of God, let them. Because again, like with the Ghostbusters analogy, we are very, very good at some things, other things not so much. And sometimes we need some assistance in order to make life work. And we can make it up to you in other ways, as long as you can help us get through these intense phases where we just can't function. And that's the thing about like the college kids, because I see so many kids who got through high school because again their parents were taking care of the the food, and there was food on the table. Wake up at a certain time, you had a schedule. But again, as soon as you get to college, everything is on you. You have to make all the decisions. You have to do all the self-care. It's 1,000 times more difficult, and you're still expected to perform at that same level. And then again, you get a lot of externalized blame from, people saying, "Well, you could do it before, but why can't you do it now? You must just be lazy." And of course, you start beating yourself up for that, where, the internalized ableism comes in, and boy, that's not doing anyone any favors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's odd because there's not this understanding of how that change could be so difficult because most people just, well, you've done it now for 18 years. What's wrong with you? You've woken up, you've brushed your teeth, you've eaten, you've gone through these motions, but it's almost like the routine has changed so much that you can't actually process any of this information. And so just overload.
And that's the thing about the chaos, because we process 42% more information at rest than neurotypical people do because of the hyperconnected brain. So, and because of that, and because of our exteroception, there was a statistic. It must have been in one of maybe a Sasha or a Sasha Baron Cohen, Simon Baron Cohen. Although I do believe that Sasha Baron Cohen might know more about autism than Simon Baron
I'm sure.
Cohen, but that neurotypical people have a sensory bottleneck that tunes out 98% of all sensory data, including like the buzzing of lights, the feeling of socks, all of this stuff, but we can't tune it out. So we're constantly, constantly, constantly churning through data. And as long as we have routines, we can streamline a lot of this stuff because we don't have to think about what we need to do, because this is the time I do this, this is the time I do this, this is the time I do this. But when a routine is disrupted, you have to reorganize everything. And oh my God, that causes a brain crash. And it's incredibly difficult to deal with that. And in college, if you don't have people to help you reorganize and restructure, that can cause a lot of problems.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
Thank you for tuning in to part one of our conversation with Matt Lowry. Be sure to join us next week for part two, where we will dive deeper into his thoughts about special interests or spins, his opinion on the DSM-5, and some advice for parents. Stay tuned. We love hearing from you, so if you have questions, comments, or just want to connect, you can find our links to LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram on our show notes. Feel free to drop us a message, leave us a comment, or ask a question, or just share your thoughts with us. Your thoughts matter, and we can't wait to hear from you.